On the issue of the income and expenditure, I said we don't want to present our position on nationalization. We have a very thick paper from the union around nationalization. What this means, it means if you have SAA currency, if you have SAA currently operating in a loss, National Treasury must approve a bailout plan and a financial injection. Now, we're putting this to indicate that if you have mines nationalized, all of them, you must have reserves. So in case there's a shortfall in that entity called mining, you should bail it like any other entity that you're bailing. So it's not something new that we're presenting here, Chair. So we're not interested so much in telling you our presentation, but we can tell you, Chair, that one, we agree 100% with the Secretary General of the ANC on his interpretation that mineral wealth beneath the soil have been nationalized through the MPRDA Section 3. We agree with the SG of the 100% as a union. In fact, in that position, we're saying that mineral wealth beneath the soil have been nationalized. But what we're saying is that you should never limit a question of nationalization to the existence of the Freedom Charter. It should be on the basis of socio-economic context, on the basis of ideological context, and on the basis of the class context. Are you nationalizing on whose behalf? Who are the intended beneficiaries of that process? So we must also deal with that as DA, that even if they are nationalized, on whose behalf are they nationalized? That's why you're not interested in nationalization. It's because you have an ideological position of pushing free market systems. So that's our view. Prescription, Chair. On the prescription, what we're indicating here, it's very simple, that the intended consequences of the Employment Equity Act are reversed through a narrow interpretation of who forms part of the previously disadvantaged South Africans. And it's done chauvinistically. People know what they're doing. They're fighting the regime than appointing white women. All what they're doing is that they don't want to affirm black people. Because the Employment Equity Act has a loophole of inclusion of white women, they're exploiting that. So we're not saying to do precisely that, but we're saying Parliament must speak on that, because it's a reversal. And in terms of the union's position on your question, we have now reviewed our position that all employment equity plans, we interrogate them on the basis of context, not how many people, on the basis of who are they. Because if you're looking as to how many, you like Department of Labor approving even reverse racism through women and not males in this. We're looking as to who are those people that are in your plan, contextually, in this instance. Royal Bafokeng, no. We're not having any problem with this, but we're saying this must be used as a basis to have a policy for beneficiation by other traditional authorities that would have similar arrangement and communities, so that it's not only in Royal Bafokeng. And others would have to come to Parliament and request you to have intervention in this instance. Okay. Now, on the issue of the ownership, the issue of the community, what we're preventing here is a situation where you have ghost mines or ghost towns. You have ghost towns. Initially, you have a town dominant with mining, but when mining declines, it becomes a ghost town. Nobody has an interest in that particular town. That's our view. That's why we're saying on the hostels, You must bring in human settlement departments, because we essentially saying for any new mine to be opened, there shall be no should be no allowance for a hostel whatsoever. It should be on the basis of integrating those workers with established townships or towns there, because currently, even with mine townships, Iscon Plus, Nazaz Muslim, and so on, is mine before came here. We were such Iscon Plus at Delmas. Yeah. Now, Iscon Plus, it's not proclaimed a township. It becomes a township only when the mine takes it back to the municipality. That's where the problem is. You still have hostels and mining suburbs as private land. And this instance, that's what you must also deal with that. Look, Chair, on the issue of the ownership, we want an incremental approach than a prescriptive claim. Don't claim that we need 60%. It must be informed by your broader strategy that we said develop a mining strategy. If you say by 2025, dominant in the mining sector should be the state, then you develop a capacity internally for you to achieve that. That's what we're saying. Now, the issue of 2014 and 2019, we're saying from 2014, if it were to be according to our view, Comrade Chair, Honorable Member, it would be better if mining licenses new should be approved on the basis of a changed ownership by 2014. We're doing this on the basis that we know your term ends in that time. There's going to be new elections, general elections at that time. And our view is that also on the moratorium on licenses, don't create a situation where discussions lead to economic processes being blocked in this instance. Licenses must be linked to the term of office of government. So a license must be approved for 5 years. So that it does not give time a coming government into arrangement. So on this call for moratorium on licenses, Chair, we would not support it because it has implications to our existence as a union. Because if you don't approve licenses, it means that there's a problem on security of jobs there. Unless you pass an act of parliament that you don't approve parliament's licenses, but there shall be no retrenchments or mine closures. Now we'll agree with that. Unless you cover us, so we'll be fine with that one, Chair. We'll be fine. On the issue of seismic occurrences, Chair, we are arguing that finance must find additional resources for this technology. We can't die in parliament. It's tied up because there's limited resources from the state. We are dying underground. So finance must find resources, because if I die because of a rock burst, the state ultimately takes a responsibility of my kids and my beneficiaries. That's how these things are linked. So a death in a mine has an implication on the social security net in the country. So we must have an interest that we must not die. In fact, we are voters. Why would we accept that we die because there's no money? You're not going to have voters, Chair. On the issue, Chair, of licensing and other departments, let's face the reality. If you launch a state mining company now, it is going to be the responsibility of public enterprises with the current regime. Because you can't be a regulator and be the operator. That's what it means. It goes to public enterprises, the state mining company. We are not accepting that situation. We think that it must still reside with DMR. Now, the issue of licensing, just be open, comrades. Any person who applies for a business license goes to trade and industry. is mine, not a business. Because we're saying that if you have a state mining company on your own in DMR, that state mining company must not have privilege because it's a state mining company. It must apply equal like any other private company applying for operating license and be checked whether it complies with regulations. Now, you can't house a state mining company and want all the mines to apply to the same state mining company. That goes also to a next question that you asked us, that the mining rights be vested to the state mining company. No. And we don't agree that, that others must apply to another state mining company. Can't be possible in this instance. So we're preventing, if you agree that it must go to public enterprise, fine, we don't have a problem. We'd have to go and fight with public enterprise, but develop a clear legislation before it goes to public enterprises. Because this thing of state-owned companies not aligned to line departments, it's also a problem. It's also a problem, Chair, on our own, Chair. On the, we've given you a position on the moratorium. On the issue of hostels, then we have explained. On the issue of beneficiation, 10%. Within that, 10% for all minerals mined should be a basis for a start, because currently it applies to diamonds. Now, for all minerals, remember, if you do this 10%, on the back of your mind, the state already would have 31%. Now, it is given 10% free, it changes it, it owns there 60% on that 10%. So I don't think that is a real problem unless you then improve as going forward. But also you must have a base to start. Don't think that because it's the state, everything would be possible under the state. Remember that we said that it's not inherently progressive, but you said that even private business is not inherently efficient, and this is a beneficiation. Financial vehicles. Now, here it's not a hard, dry suggestion, but we're telling you a reality. If you have a state mining company and PIC makes an investment in a mine, that investment is on behalf of PIC, not on behalf of a state mining company. That's the reality. And if IDC does the same, so you would have a state mining company, a shell company, that would be in competition with state-owned financial institutions. So if you decide not to have your own to invest in mining, but then develop legislation that compels a state funder, that if it funds, then the shares would be held on its behalf by the state mining company. We're arguing only on the basis that you would have competition within the state. And ultimately, you may have PIC and IDC and DPSA owning more shares than the state mining company. If you develop a legislation to prescribe that, even if PIC does invest or IDC or LIMDEF, that they do, and knowing well that the shares would be held on their behalf by the state mining company. We don't want competition on shareholding on behalf of the state, because your distribution would not have more informed resources, because some resources go elsewhere for particular shareholders to decide on. I think that's all that we wanted to reflect, but over and above that, sir, we must appreciate that this portfolio committee that we are presenting in it today has at least changed the interaction between Parliament and civil society. So we've had quite a number of interactions with this portfolio committee and appreciate that, but you must ensure that you at least tighten up your involvement, because if you allow, this thing may be executive and legislative. If the executive is not doing well on monitoring implementation of a legislative authority, then Parliament must stand up. You may not have powers to instruct executive, But the executive also does not have powers to misrepresent legislative processes. So some of the processes may seem to be necessities of DMR, but Comrade Fred has explained, with your oversight role, it must be clear that some of the issues will raise very sharp with Parliament, because it's the higher structure to us compared to executive. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let's thank NUM, and indeed, like we have done with the other presenters, we will apply our minds to the submission, and that, let me repeat that this fourth parliament, as an activist parliament, would be more decisive than ever, because we have a clear call, instruction, marching orders by the president, that we need to work smarter, we need to work faster, so that there are results at the end of each process. Thank you very much. Let's take Legal Resources Center. You want it? Yes? Please come down to connect your things for so long.
No, Chair, just for a minute. I just wanted to indicate that we hope that we'll be able to get a consolidated report of all the presenters.
Yes.
So that, like you're saying, we are supposed to apply our minds so that we as a committee are able to then deliberate around these issues and also determine a way forward as to what next in terms of oversight. I'm saying this, Chair, because we need to start focusing on implementation processes and actually becoming clear as a committee as to what are we saying now after all the consultative processes that we've had. And also to have a clear indication as to, in terms of the priorities that have been put before us, health, education, and so on, in relation to all the repeated issues that have been said, what are we saying, what are we doing as a committee, so that we can also start getting direction in terms of progress.
No, definitely we will. The first step would be to consult to put together in a file all the submissions by the committee secretary, so that you have one file that contains all submissions that were made. Arising out of that, we can have an executive summary from our point of view, which will be subject to yourselves for interaction and deliberation, but it's still a bit distant. I think we would do it in phases. Maybe the first phase would be to determine what next after the, more especially after the study tour. We would then have to sit down and do some analysis. Maybe if you want the file without consolidation, it can be made available before we go on recess, so that during the period, then you can familiarize yourselves with that. Honorable Schmidt?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do get the kind of impression that we're not always aware of the exact issues on the ground. And I say so with regards to, let's say, hostels. There are certain mine companies who have sold their hostels as local government functions. Some have not. Some have renovated. Some have not. And, you know, we are making general broad sweeping statements, and I'm not sure, you know, some of it might involve local government, but we need to establish somehow some of those facts to say, this is the position in certain hostels and other hostels. This is the position, and therefore we propose the following solution to it. But we've got a very broad brush approach. And the only way of determining it is to try and institute something like a monthly or bi-monthly visit with a specific focus, because otherwise we'll constantly be discussing things here in the air. And clearly, I think the NUM's representative here indicated certain factual issues on the ground which, you know, would need to tie up. But that would be a proposal flowing from what the previous speaker said, you know.
We'll take those into account. But there's a mining summit report, which I think it's now out, which also reflected on this matter. where they said to date about 36% of accommodation arrangement in the mining industry still single sex hostels, which means there has been quite a serious move in conversion. And then, like you say, some hostels being given to the municipality and so forth. It's either we then use that, and if it's not detailed enough in terms of pointing out which mine houses, like for instance, at Anglo American, is it Harmony, that still have this, then it might mean that we can go out in that targeted fashion. So, yes, in everything that has been put through to us, we will have to lift them from these submissions and agree on the process going forward, including the oversight will be the our practice in the main. We'll spend more time out there in the field, looking objectively at what is obtaining, asking the right questions to the players on the ground. Thank you very much. Legal Resources Center, introduce yourselves.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you for inviting us to supplement our written submission and we want to keep it to 15 minutes of a short presentation to you. We're also looking forward to seeing the communities appearing before your committee next term when they will be making submissions. I'm Ink Smith. I work for Legal Resources Centre in Cape Town. Janet Love apologizes for not representing us. She's our national director. Mr. Tulani Faku is my younger colleague who is more enthusiastic about taking on the challenges of mining and a new dispensation for mining. And our we have volunteers who help us. Rasmus is behind me and Daniel right at the back. Our submission is numbered from pages 1 to 20.
Sorry, the lady in the middle. The Rasmus is the one.
Rasmus.
Just be immediately behind you. And the lady.
Rashma.
Rashma. Oh, okay. And
Daniel.
Daniel.
Yeah. They're not all American.
Thank you.
American. Our written submission consists of a two-page letter, then a submission and a few slides, and we really want to get to the slides. The Legal Resources Centre is a public interest law firm. We do not represent civil society, we represent communities in court cases, often against government, like in the Kolobeni case, where a foreign Australian investor is attempting to mine a sand dune. The Sekurue case, where we're helping the community in relating to a lease, and Anglo Platts. But we also work with government, and we've joined the Commission and the Department of Rural Development in challenging the attempt by the Royal Bafokeng Nation to incorporate and take ownership of 55 trust farms belonging to communities, but which the Royal Bafokeng Nation is attempting in terms of an ex parte court application initially to take ownership of in the pending a new Communal Land Rights Act that must be written. We've also come to your committee since 2001 with an original act, the bill, and the royalty bill, and subsequent amendments. On the top of page 2 of our letter, we want to emphasize that this is a very important event, what you're doing, to take stock of where the MPRDA is going since 2002 and its slow implementation process to correct historic imbalances. But we must look, if we are serious about transformation measures at international best practice, at international law, and how we can justify legally our transformation measures. And we're going to point to what is happening in Africa, and it's apposite to do so because we had Africa Day earlier this week, and your committee also had visitors from the Africa Parliament. I want to quickly show you that at the beginning of our submission proper, and Tulani will address you on the specific proposals we're making in paragraph 25 thereof, but on page 3 in the submission proper, I just want to show two paragraphs that we mentioned there.
We say that the starting point is this. Inequity in the mining industry has its roots in the dispossession of the African population and communities of their land. We're saying that the MPRDA, the current dispensation, does not compensate for past injustice and plunder. The MPRDA and the current regime introduced a limited notion of transformation in the form of black economic empowerment. It has not, and this is what we want to see, empowered African communities holding a genuine stake and participating in the industry, in mining. This must be taken into account as one of the possible transformation measures, along with, in combination with, or as discrete measures, the other possibilities in the basket, namely nationalization, direct participation by the state, specific special taxes, and others. Now we're fortunately getting to the slides. Chair, the slides are also numbered, and I just wanted to show how where our justification for deep transformation measures can be found in law. Now, international law, along with common law, customary law and statute law have stated under our constitution. So the 1986 African Charter specifically addresses the right of people, that is nations and communities, to exploit their own resources. It addresses the issue of international monopolies in our continent, and it says that states has a duty to exercise the right to development. Now that those principles are reflected in our own statute law, in our own constitution, and Polokwane resolution is one of those implementation statements. We want to point out that the Polokwane resolution specifically addresses, in fact, is preoccupied with the promotion of sustainable development of local communities. It has other concerns also, but it says sustainable development of local communities. And we must look at the amendments to the Act last year, came through last year, actually an amendment of 2008, which is not yet in operation. Let me come back to the Africa scenario, because we see examples of how the Africa continent attempted to address sections 21 and 22. And there was a recent court case of the Enderwa community on a Bohora Lake in Kenya, which earlier this year, the General Assembly and the Africa Commission recommended and decided, instructed the state that that community must be, their ownership of the land must be recognized. They must be compensated for their removal from the land when a forestry reserve and a ruby mine was established on their land. And that in future, the mine and the forest company must pay royalties to that community. That is how the principle has been applied in a jurisdiction on our continent. There are other nice statements in that judgment which we think assists us. It says that the community cannot be left out of the development process or benefits, and it says that the community must give its free prior informed consent before development that will impact on it can happen. How is that translated in the South African situation? Now I'm looking at page 21 at slide number 7. In South Africa, our MPRDA addresses communities. We'd say inadequately so, but a start has been made. The Amendment Act 49 of 2008 signed by the President on 21 April 2009, but not yet in operation, shall come into operation on the date fixed by Parliament. Amend Section 17 and 23, plus I should add there, and if you have that page open, please do so, Item 7 of Schedule 2, so it also applies to conversion applications, old order to new order conversion applications.
Excuse me, where are you reading?
Sorry, sir. I'm on page 21.
Page 21.
The big number at the top, and it's slide number 7.
Oh.
Yeah. And it
all right.
It's the one on the screen at the moment. Yeah. And if any of the honourable members do not have a copy, Rasmus can quickly hand them a copy.
Well written.
Yeah.
In that LRC, he got
can you help?
Yeah. So that's page 21.
Apologies. Yeah. He wants one. And do you want one?
No.
You say it. Yeah.
Okay.
It says that if the application relates to land occupied by a community, the minister may impose conditions to protect their rights and require their participation. It doesn't go further, and we say it may be too little too late because conversion has already happened, and it's completely discretionary, no guidance from Parliament, which we've heard earlier. In any event, it's not yet in operation. The Minister cannot impose it yet. Section 2 of the Act was also amended by the Amendment Act. It specifically addresses communities and women in the principles, the developmental principles in Section 2 of the Act that must inform all decision-making under the legislation. Chair, we're on my last slide. It simply refers to Section 12 of the Act, which contains a number of transformation measures, possibilities, or gives the authority to the department to take measures in this regard. And it could include development funds, exploration funds, incubation facilities and programs, and banking. And it should be aimed at communities. And your committee has also filed questions in this regard to the department on progress in this regard. Chair, I must end off because it's now Tulani's turn. In my last sentence of our covering letter, I refer to your your warning to us when Khosi Matlabane of the Bahamahidi community addressed you 2 weeks ago. You said that we must further explore the concept community, its definition, the social and spatial boundaries of communities, and the challenges relating to accountability, democratic practices, and elite capture by chiefs, by traditional leaders, by powerful men, by powerful directors, at the expense of the youth, and at the expense of women. Chair, we've not talked to you about social and labour plans and IDPs and the huge shortcomings in that regard from the viewpoint of communities, and we'd like to do so if you give us half a chance. All the Land Claims Commission and land reform and the management problems relating to land reform that the President reportedly made a statement about earlier today, and we'd like the opportunity to do so if you request us to do so. Tulani will now address the specific issues that we raise in paragraph 25 and the 6 bullet points of our submission proper, and he has 4 slides in that regard. Thanks, Chair.
I greet you all. I'd like to thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. that we address here at this platform. We'll start with the paragraph 25 of the conclusions that we make. I'm just trying to get them on the screen right now.
Amongst the many propositions that we make, we say that the empowerment of the historically marginalized and therefore disadvantaged communities who were the direct victims of apartheid spatial design and compartmentalized design should be the first priority in pursuit of Black economic empowerment. And their exclusion from ownership, including equity and all royal participation, should require a very much cogent justification. The lack of protection of the interests of the historically disadvantaged communities in the face of financial and the technical resources that established mining companies have at their disposal to support the narrow interests of their shareholders results in the state either intentionally or unintentionally supporting the interests of the relatively wealthy rather than protecting the interests of the poor. It is therefore essential that due process and adequate support and advice are issued in the election of community representatives, in making decisions, in developing and signing agreements and decisions that clearly protect their interests. There are many examples that we could cite of community claims for participation in mineral exploitation and on their own land that have political, legal, and economic merit. New order mining law should recognize this new and this need and create enabling mechanisms to achieve outcomes that satisfy the obligation to redress the results of past racial discrimination. Perhaps to go to the slides that we have, I will start on a note of our national aspirations. I will go back to 1994 when we as a nation adopted the RDP and its principles. And one of the RDP's principles was the need for an integrated and sustainable program to overcome the legacy of apartheid. And the main focal point in all of this was to have an all-inclusive, people-driven process. Therefore, we turn this government now in 2010 that this is an activist government which will at all times endeavor to put its people's welfare and interests first among all its priorities. Therefore, by making strides to elevate the lives of ordinary South Africans in platforms such as this, we will be in keeping with the spirit captured in and embodied in the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. The issues that we've raised gravitate towards the affirmation of the inspirations of an activist government. We should make this our most prioritized mission to accomplish these. As South Africa, we emerged from an atrocious history where the rights of the voiceless, vulnerable communities have incessantly and forever been trampled upon. Under both apartheid and colonialism, we had institutionalized racism where race affected all walks of life, where you live, your level of education, how much you can earn. We had a victimization and oppression of the voiceless people. So this committee, it can help to ensure that those voices of the voice, those were previously voiceless, are heard. And the poor never go unheard in the process of the economic transformation of our country. And we can do this by endeavoring to put our people first in whatever we do. We therefore thank this House for granting us the opportunity of addressing these issues we have raised. It is therefore our hope that these legal and social concerns we have tabled will be given consideration. We need a process of thorough engagement. Let us continue to be informed by the spirit that is captured in the essence of our democratic dispensation, putting the people first and overcoming our past. We thank you.
Thank you very much. No further additions from legal resources?
No.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, there you have the presentation from the Legal Resources Center. let us engage with that submission. Honorable Schmidt. Okay. Let's take you so far.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one of your submissions make for relatively heavy reading. It's a legal document in its sincere form, because you have footnotes and refer to land claims acts and sections and legal conclusions. But my two issues which I do want to raise, the one is, isn't there an answer to a certain degree in the Royal Buffalo King, the success of the Royal Buffalo King, and the way they've developed it, albeit rather on their own, but they're the role model in my view insofar as communities are concerned, by plug and by pull and by push factors at all times, and they've succeeded in a very, very successful, as far as I'm aware, benefit to their community. Shouldn't one concentrate on that particular role model and see how one can facilitate that to more other communities, and the legal dispensation, whether that would allow communities? There's a vast difference in time between the time period within which Royal Buffalo King did their capacitation and the current position. Now, I've read your documents, I understand the legal process, and understand that the rights have been diminished, if not extinguished, and I think your argument is that it's been extinguished. But isn't there some process in which one can revive that kind of process of Royal Buffalo King? And then secondly, is your argument that in terms of the Africa Commission and General Assembly of the African Union, isn't your argument that we're already in trouble? Because if what you say, if you want to call that an international best practice at least, or international law, I'm not sure they can call it international law, but let's say it's international best practice, maybe, you know. But aren't we falling foul of those prescripts? Because we, whether you like it or not, we've raised the issue that MPRDA basically, in reality, led to expropriation. I know it raises all kinds of issues and hairs and counter arguments and dissatisfaction, but in effect, to communities, it has led to expropriation. It has led to it's legally not expropriation, because you can file for damages if you can prove your damages, and you know, how does the community prove its damages? How do you get all those reports? How do you get all the experts? In reality, it comes down to expropriation. Now, if that is so, what is it what you suggest? Because if we've become expropriated communities of the value of the mineral rights attached to that land, or the right to claim or submit an application, what is it that we can do now to benefit this community? What is it what you suggest? Thank you. Going forward.
Thank you, Honorable Hululu.
Very much. Thank you very much, Chair. And let me also thank the legal services for their presentation. If I look at this legal document, it's difficult for me to even challenge the document itself. But I just want to find out from Mr. Smith about, for instance, the question of Alexco, where they claimed the mine, the land, the Richtersveld community. About your involvement there, as to are you involved in that process there? Because from what I know, it's that they were given part of the land by government, and but they still don't get their royalties from Alexco. What would be your view on that one, actually, as a legal body? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's give you some more so that when you respond, you can then respond comprehensively. From your slides, the Kenya experience that you are drawing to our attention and the existence of the African Charter, of what status is this charter in your understanding? Is it binding to member states, or is it a one of the articles similar to the UN, you know, articles, for example, or ILO conventions, fashion? And if whatever way you answer, in your understanding, has South Africa ratified? Has South African government ratified, you know, this charter at any given stage? Secondly, just a comment that it's ironical that you were able to pull some of the relevant sections of the Polokwane resolution when other people claim that they do not exist. I think yourself and NUM, you know, have quoted directly from one of the resolutions in the resolve part of our economic resolution. So you're lifting it. I know here that your emphasis is on the communities, but if you read that resolution in its totality and you unpack, you would see that we've taken a resolution that led us to the process that we are in now. The other matter, you're making a constant reference to the amendments that were effected and proclaimed by the president, but not yet implemented. What could be the reason for not implementation? Because if my memory serves me correctly, there are two sections whose implementation date was suspended. Which would not be enforceable, but now you know as legal people you would know better. You're making that direct reference that these amendments in totality are not yet implemented, and I would just like to find out what could be those reasons, because sometimes when we go to oversight, you know, especially people who are in this committee in the third parliament would be of the view that we amended the law and that they would expect to see those amendments being part of what the department must implement. Coming to your conclusions and your recommendations, your bullet point one, which makes a reference to the allocation of mineral rights and the manner that exacerbates the existing negative impact on the resolution of the land claims. Now, I'm going to put this question to you. You can answer it in any way you want. I'm linking it to your earlier submission that some of our legislative framework does not go far enough in terms of tackling in a serious manner the whole question of redressing the imbalances of the past, including the MPRD in your input. Now, would this question of land reforms and at a later stage some of decisions that we may want to take on mineral resources arena, would they not what would be their relationship to Section 25 of the Constitution? Does the problem, in your view, in terms of land claims, lie in that provision for the Constitution of the country, the property clause, or does it lie somewhere else? Because I think we would also would tease out this question going forward consistently with legal people, but now that we've got you before us, we would want to get your views on that, because yes, we agree with you that there are those frustrations that do take place. The last bullet point you raising a serious question of the revenue generated from the licenses in terms of prospecting, mining, and royalties. You're saying that accrued in relation to trust land. Is there a particular trust land? For instance, we've got Ingonyama Trust land, which is in the KZN. You've got other, you know, trust lands such as in Royal Bafokeng, and so forth. So that we then are aware of what is this that you are referring to. Please answer us on those, and we'll see if there's a second one. Is there an immediate follow-up question?
In fact, there's one that I was supposed to ask as well, in addition to the one that I asked earlier on, in relation to the Kolobeni community in the Eastern Cape. I'm sure you are aware of that one, Kolobeni. What are the key issues in there? And in fact, the community seems to be differing in whether the mining industry activity should happen or not. Why is this, and what is LCR involvement in the in that in that process? Thank you.
That would be Honourable Bigani.
Chair, what I'd like to know is what legally binding legislation is there presently on issues related to, for example, we have a problem with this acid drainage, where if nothing is being done within a particular time frame, perhaps, what immediate action can be taken. And then in terms of, you are mainly concentrating on communities, benefits to communities in terms of legislation that is already there. But what pressure can we then as a country apply to ensure that that legislation actually becomes a legal matter that enforces on the department to move faster in terms of ensuring that communities are attended to in relevant areas of need?
Thank you very much. Would you care to respond to those? You got something? Please respond.
Thank you very much, Chair. And there are 10 points that I've made, and as often in this committee, Ms. Pikani, Member Pikani has put out the big challenge on how legislative reform, but in fact implementation can move faster and quicker. But I'll start with a seventh question which you raised on the Development Trust and Land Act of 1936, which established a fund where all the mining royalties and lease monies accrued to a trust fund. What has happened to the trust monies? Under the Abolition of Racially Discriminatory Land Measures Act of 1986, the trust was disbanded. The monies went somewhere. Communities are still asking what happened to their monies that was supposed to come to them. They lived in homelands, they got meager royalties and surface lease monies, but it was dispersed from this trust fund that was supposed to help build schools on their land. What has happened to the monies? Nobody can tell us, and we've asked the minister a few times about that. We're still getting that question, and you will get that question next term. That's why we've included it. It should not be the last bullet point. It should be the first bullet point, because we were exploited, but even the little that we were supposed to have got, we never got. Now we're planning new dispensations, but what about the past? It is an issue which recurs in our engagements with communities. The land claims delay.
Sorry, can you repeat the act that established those trusts and the act that repealed?
Yeah, sorry, Chair, I'm rushing over it because I also want to get to your other questions. But the Development Trust and Land Act, the relevant provision is quoted on page 16. It's section 23, and it's on page 16 of our handout. We've included it there as a schedule. And the Abolition Act abolished it, and we have reference in our paper to the Abolition Act also. That's a 1986 Act of a pre-constitutional government. The alignment and coordination between land claims, the 1994 legislation, and the MPRDA never happened. There were supposed to be sunset clauses and to ensure that land claims are dealt with whilst new mining applications happen. We explain in our document that the attempts at policy level to align these two processes was unsuccessful. We find that the majority of rural land claims are still unresolved. But mining applications and prospecting applications for new mining on land-claimed land is happening apace. This is a real problem for communities. At the time in 2001, with a bill, we made proposals on how it could be addressed, but it's an unresolved issue. Land claims have been politicized to a large extent. The rights-based nature of land claims overshadowed by political decisions by the Commission and large parts of our country, rural land, under land claims. But that does not absolve us from the responsibility of attempting at a level of principle to address the alignment of mining, new mining happening on land, and land claims. Also, the historical exploitation of minerals on land claimed. If I'm getting a denuded, the community gets land back that is of lesser value because the minerals have been taken from the land, or the land has been rendered not usable. It cannot be used. It's been sterilized. You can't graze cattle on it. That matter should also be addressed. So we're saying it's very important that these two processes do speak to one another, which is not the case at the moment. The African Charter stands alongside the Constitution. It was signed and ratified. Implementation of decisions of recommendations by the Commission, once approved by the General Assembly of the Africa Union, which is what happened in the Addis Ababa resolution of March on the Indorwa, the state must report annually on progress with regard to that recommendation. Compared to the international instruments on other continents, it's one of the strongest, and South Africa has committed itself by signing and ratifying the Charter to implement the decisions of its constituting bodies. It's stronger than the SADC Charter. It's stronger than SADC decisions by the Vintu Court. But we're saying it is as important to bring our statutes in alignment with soft law proposals by international law. And your committee could well, as we've discussed, consider the proposals by the code or protocol being prepared by the Africa Economic Commission and the UNDP on, it's a protocol on mining in Africa, and especially the conduct of foreign companies and South African companies in other parts of Africa. You recognize that we are preoccupied with the issue of communities, but that's our brief, and we'll stick to our brief. But it's a pillar of a new economic policy and transformation of economic relations in Africa that's got to be taken into account, and we'll have to stick to our story there. The Royal Bafokeng model is said not to be replicable because of the timing when they entered into the platinum industry, and secondly because it's platinum. But in none of the other minerals or the other sectors is it possible to make the super profits that the Royal Bafokeng originally made with a lease, converted surface rental, converted to a lease, a royalty, and now into equity. Some say they were lucky. It happened, the Royal Bafokeng model was born in illegitimacy under the Mangope regime. So it could not necessarily be replicated at the time and cannot be done so today, because communities, of course, don't start off with a stake in mining. The Alex Kor situation, where as a result of a land claim and very particular facts, resulted in a 49% equity on land mining of the Alex Kor mine. But diamonds are not being mined on land, largely, at Alex Kor at the moment. We were involved, Legal Resources Center was involved in the Richtersveld land claim only until 2007 with Mr. Ntsapho Moloi, who addressed you on Wednesday when he was on the other side. He was first working for government and later as chair of the Alex Kor Council. But we're unfortunately no longer involved, or fortunately so, no longer involved in that community's relationships with the mining operations on the Alex Kor land. So there are two communities that have significant stakes as owners, have equity in mining in South Africa. There's a third one, Ikwezi, which is platinum, but it's exploration. But those communities have significant stakes in mining, and I think that the Royal Bafokeng is its particular story of in the platinum industry, and it had to do with the timing that they entered. However, we're not saying that communities as of right must have a certain stake. The previous presenter had on the slide 23 of 35, or the seventh last slide, indicated a 10%. Now that's a very important starting point, that communities should be recognized as stakeholders for new mining on their own land, more so where there's past or current mining, but there was a historical disposition or taking. Should there be a ceiling? Not necessarily so. It depends on the circumstances. And if there was historical exploitation, it may mean that the community should have a higher or better bargaining position in working out an equitable equity stake, royalty arrangement, if they don't want to go into take the risk of a new venture. So the community participation, we say, really depends on the circumstances, but it should be supervised if required, and there should be probably statutory normative standards to guide and direct parties in these very important constituting moments of a new venture or a restructuring of an existing venture. Chair, the implementation of the 2008 Act, we understand that it's the non-implementation, the fact that it's not in operation, has got to do with the alignment of the MPRDA amendment with a NEMA amendment, and the supervision or the decision-making powers of the one department, mineral resources, with regard to environmental authorizations, and a enforceable or unenforceable arrangement between the two previous ministers in this regard. There was said to be a two-year period in terms of which there would be a handover of environmental authorization. Now that impact on the other amendment in that act and it being implemented, including the possibility of community participation. Unfortunately, there are problems even in this regard. As you will remember, the Amendment Act watered down in Section 5 the possibility of community consultation and consent to mining happening on their land, new mining happening on their land. So 2008 amendment gave with the one hand, but also took away with the other hand. The important thing for communities is their bargaining position at the start and throughout the relationship with the ventures on their land, with development on their land. Chair, I will not do justice to the Kolobeni issue by trying to raise it here when Kolobeni is queuing up to come to your committee next term. But Kolobeni, it's a strange kind of appeal that's currently before a subcommittee of the advisory committee to the minister. And it's got to do with